I'm Julie Height, and this is Nashville. Today we're talking Cowboy Carter, Act 2 of Beyoncé's three-part project. The first was Renaissance, which drew on the black and queer roots of dance and house music. Now, Cowboy Carter is her exploration of country, a genre that is often thought of as being everything Beyoncé is not, despite her Texas roots and her ability to get every bit as down-home in her music as she wants, when she wants, like she did in Daddy Lessons. We knew there would be some resistance to the idea of Beyoncé applying her curatorial and conceptual brilliance to country music because it's happened before to her and so many other black country performers before her. My first guest today is Alice Randall, longtime Nashville resident, in my opinion, underappreciated country songwriter, novelist, poet, educator, and historian of black country originators. She revisits her creative and cultural legacy and theirs in her book, My Black Country, which is coming out next week, along with an album of the same title. Alice, welcome to This Is Nashville.
Julie, so wonderful to be here with you and with Holly G.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We are almost a week out from the release of Cowboy Carter at this point and the response to it, which you have actively contributed to. So I'm wondering, how are you feeling?
Well, part of it is excited and exhausted, to be truthful. Mm-hmm. Excited. It's a 16 carriages moment. There's a lot of work going on.
And, yes.
A lot of work going on. But I am actually thrilled to be living through an important musical cultural moment in not only America, but the world. This is a moment that the whole world is listening to an album and talking about that album.
It is. And hopefully next week they will be listening to and talking about your album and your book, which we will get to later in the show. But I'm curious, I mean, you have already seen Beyoncé achieve something that you had been looking for decades when she topped the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart. What were you hoping for from the album itself?
I don't know what I was hoping for. I know what I found. To me, I love the album. I think the album functions almost in the same way that Shakespeare functions. It entertains on the surface and gives us a wide variety of texts that you can enter into and make a reflection of yourself and your own intents. It's so rich. It responds to all kinds of analysis from many different directions. But what I also found is it feels a little bit like a giant family reunion in which the entire family is invited. And in the South, we have a lot of family reunions where the black side of the family is not invited, or we have reunions where the white side of the family is not invited. But here in Cowboy Carter, we have a musical family reunion in which the whole family is invited, actually.
Yeah. And I mean, Beyoncé has implied that this album is partially a response to the profound lack of welcome that she received when she performed on the CMA Awards with the Chicks in 2016. But I wonder, Alice, how you hear her response to being told that she didn't belong in country music, or who you hear her speaking to.
Well, one, I hope she's speaking to the ghost of Roy Acuff. Because thinking about the CMA Awards in 2016, I think one of the stories I tell in My Black Country is I got to attend the 25th anniversary of the CMA Awards in 1983.
Right.
I attended that 2 days before I drove down to Nashville. And I've been here 41 years in country music. And one of the truly offensive things about that evening, and there were many, was that Roy Acuff stood on the stage and said, country music has always been a family. And then he talked about the great Jimmy Rogers. He talked about Will Rogers. He did not mention D. Ford Bailey. And he had been on the stage. D. Ford had helped launch Roy Acuff's career.
Right.
And so many of the early Opry stars, because D. Ford Bailey was the first superstar of the Grand Ole Opry and a black man.
Right.
So that they could call all those names and not call Dee Fords and call this thing a family.
Hmm.
That's when the beginning of my first family of black country was born. And that was the name they should have called. Hmm. Dee Ford Bailey as a father, Lil Hardin Armstrong, who played on Blue Yodel number 9, mm-hmm. as the mama. Ray Charles as their genius child, Charlie mm-hmm. Pride as Dee Ford's side child, and Herb Jeffries, who was alive at the time of that show and was not invited to the show. The bronze mm-hmm. buckaroo who made all these 1930s and early 40s black singing cowboy records and
right.
films, and he's not even invited. Now, they do have Ray Charles and Charlie Pride on the show. And it closes with Ray Charles. But we were in DAR Constitution Hall. And it was right. reminding me of when Marian Anderson was not allowed to sing there. Because they were saying it's a family. And they're saying this is America. And the black people have only a limited role. And the black women have no role at all. There was not a single black woman on the show.
Right.
And so to me, Beyoncé at the top of the charts was some good news at long last.
Right.
And
right.
I do hope the other good news I am looking for, and on, I truly hope that she is invited to the CMA Awards this coming year and treated right, whether or not she chooses to make, to accept that invitation. That will be up to her.
But I hope
they invite her and truly treat her right, because she has earned that.
Yes.
And America has earned that, because we need to experience the varieties of black music working in country being celebrated in
yes.
Nashville, Tennessee.
And I mean, this show right here, right now, today is about looking at the many different kinds of creative and intellectual and professional and artistic labor that black women have been doing in the country music space across generations. You know, we're here talking about the use of agency. And my next guest, who you already mentioned, is Holly G., the founder of the Black Opry, who went from starting a little blog, just reaching out to find other black country fans and artists 3 years ago, which is it's crazy to imagine, to building an entire network and platform, building a world to support them. Welcome back to This is Nashville, Holly.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be sitting here with both of you today.
Now, I know that you have been asked to talk about Beyoncé quite a bit since February. And I wonder what that's been like, what sort of labor that has required of you, and what parts of it have been joyful, what parts you are tired of.
I think for me, the exhaustion feels the heaviest when, you know, we're taking the time out to do these interviews and they're centering around, they're almost like circumnavigating the work that we're actually doing. My goal is always going to be to uplift the artists that we work with here, to support emerging artists and develop careers. And so we're really grateful for the attention. But we aren't always able to use it for the greater good, I think.
Right.
Beyoncé is wonderful and she's a global celebrity, but I don't really think she needs any more press. and so I've really appreciated the opportunities that we've gotten where they have looked at us and said, we are here because of Beyoncé, but we want to talk about the work that you guys are doing. I've been very, very grateful for that. And I think probably the most joyful part of it has been seeing all of these black faces that are coming towards what we're doing and being engaging and curious. And, you know, we went to a listening party last Friday that was thrown by A.B. Eastwood and a
yes.
few other people that I hope you remember, because I would like to name all of them. But it was wonderful. And it was just like a room full of black people celebrating mm-hmm. country music. And I feel
down
like,
on Lower Broadway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is something that we've been working so hard towards. And so I'm excited for us to be able to build a black audience, because I think finding a different audience for country music is the key to how we keep Black country music alive. It's not going to be through the main systems that already exist.
Right.
I think at this point they've moved as far as they're going to move. And so we have to just acknowledge that, okay, they're going to give us crumbs, but we have our own agency, we have our own power, and we can all come together and build something better.
And I mean, through the Black Opry, you work with hundreds of Black artists at this point, most of whom only have really a fraction of the visibility that Beyoncé has and the budget that she has. And it makes me wonder if so far you feel like conversations have focused on what you feel like they should focus on and to what degree you have seen it impacting artists that you work with the way that you would like to see. I mean, how much have you seen that or not?
I think I would love to see a lot more of the conversations talk about some of the work that has been done in the past by people like Alice, people like Recy Palmer. I'm super excited to see Linda Martell be featured on the album.
Yeah.
That's work that Recy's been doing, is trying to get Linda Martell to the forefront for years.
Right.
And so what I don't want to happen is, because we're in the midst of a major celebrity, for that to overshadow the work of the people that have been here this whole time.
Right. Right.
I'm very proud that in 2010, I think I published the first major article on Linda Martell in the modern era, certainly in the
beautiful
21st.
Piece in the Oxford American. Yeah.
And so, you know, you guys have been here doing this work for so long, and so, like, I just hope that all of the light gets shined in all the places that deserve it.
Yeah. So. Well, since we're talking about Linda Martell, let's bring in our third guest who is joining us remotely today. My third guest is Markia Thompson, the granddaughter of the artist Linda Martell, who released a very fine album called Color Me Country back in 1970 and became the first Black woman to place a single in the top 25 of the country chart. Kia is making a documentary about her grandmother's life and career. Kia, welcome to This Is Nashville.
Thanks for having me, Julie. And hello to Alice and Holly.
So good to hear from you, Kia. I hope you're hanging in there.
Hey, Kia.
All right. I'm here.
Yes. Well, we are going to dig into your grandmother's story and the film that you are making. But first, do we have time to hear her voice on the Cowboy Carter album? Play that.
Okay, thank you so very much. Ladies and gentlemen, this particular tune stretches across a range of genres, and that's what makes it a unique listening experience. Yes, indeed. It's called Yaya.
That was so exciting to hear Linda Martell's voice, actual voice, on Cowboy Carter. We're going to get into the story of Linda Martell's career and her accomplishments in just a bit. After the break, we will continue the conversation with Alice Randall, Kia Thompson, and Holly G. Stay with us. This is Nashville. I'm Julie Height, and this is Nashville. I've been talking with author, songwriter, and country expert Alice Randall, Black Opry founder Holly G, and Kia Thompson, granddaughter of the great artist Linda Martell. We've been discussing their reactions to Beyoncé's album, Cowboy Carter, and we just heard Linda Martell's voice on it. Kia, I'm so curious what it was like watching
watching your grandmother get the invitation from Beyoncé's team and watching the recognition of your grandmother's work in country music grow over the last few days. What was that like for you?
It's just kind of surreal. You know what I mean? Like, for my grandmother to be as talented as she was, you know, over 50 years ago when she went to Nashville, as capable as she was of being such a, you know, a big superstar, and then to not, you know, have that happen, even though she had all the tools she needed, you know, 50 some odd years later, be aligned with arguably the biggest superstar on the planet. I mean, it was just, I still, like, I'm crying off and on, because it's like, you know, for her, you know, it's just like, who'd ever thought this? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's crazy. I can't even really describe it. So it's just been wild for me to watch. So,
yeah. I mean, like you're saying, recognition has come so slowly for so many Black country pioneers. Alice was talking about Dee Ford Bailey. We're talking about Linda Martell, and so many Black performers. The influence that they have had has been overlooked and forgotten, and they have not been included in the predominantly white canon of what is considered historically important country music. And Holly, I wonder, I mean, as someone who thinks all the time about centering artists and taking care of them, when you think about Black country pioneers getting their due, what does that look like in your mind? How do you define that?
I think when you talk about, you know, methods of respect and recognition in country music, unfortunately, you have to start with what the industry centers on, and that's money. Making sure that these artists get financial compensation for not only the ways that they're now being included, but also the careers that they many oftentimes lost out on. I think that is where you start. Like, money is what speaks in country music, and so that's their language, and start there.
Compensation.
Yeah.
Compensation for creative labor.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Linda Martell is belatedly having this moment thanks to her voice and her name being on Cowboy Carter, but Beyoncé was not the first Black woman to lift up Linda Martell by any means. We were just talking about Alice Randall's beautiful meditation on Linda Martell in the Oxford American Magazine over a decade ago, and Recy Palmer naming her radio show that features so many country and roots artists of color after Linda Martell's album Color Me Country. And Kia, you have been making a movie about your grandmother. I know that she probably had already cut ties with Nashville completely by the time you were born, but could you take us back to when you were first learning about her music, learning about her career, and when you decided that you wanted to step up and look after her musical legacy?
You know, my grandmother is a very modest, very humble woman. She never talked about it. So it's like, if it weren't for the fact that we'd be out and about in a store and someone would say, like, "Hey, Linda," and we're like, "Okay, well, Grandma, why are they calling you Linda?" Like, it would have never come up. And the people who would recognize her, they didn't recognize her from anything she did in Nashville. I mean, she was she had been a star already all over the Southeast, you know?
Right.
So that conversations that she still didn't disclose much about, but our parents eventually stepped in and were like, "Well, yeah, you know, Mom's got a country music album. Yeah, she's got this." And then the pictures came out, and I had to be, I don't know, maybe if not in high school, very close to high school age, you know, so somewhere around the age of like 12 to I'll say 15, somewhere in there. But yeah, like that's how I discovered Linda Martell.
Kia, I was wondering, did you see those videos on YouTube that came out in 2009? Were you part of putting them up, or did you see them when they first came out in 2009, when people start putting up our Hee Haw episodes and putting up the whole album?
I don't know who I think it's a young man who put up the Hee Haw performance. I don't know who he is, but I am so grateful. yeah, I did not put those up. I even tried reaching out to that guy, and I don't know if it's just like a dormant, you know, YouTube, you know, account or what, but like that video is getting clicks now. So
that's how I first met you and heard the rest of her name, is that some of the family responded to that video because the video came up.
Oh, yeah.
That's how we met in the chat about a Linda Martell video for the first time about 14 years ago.
Well, that is testimony to the work that you were both doing, you know, that you were looking, you were searching, and you were ready to make those connections and, you know, lift Linda Martell up in the ways that you each could. I mean, I wonder, Kia, when you started having conversations with your grandmother, asking her about what her experiences were, I mean, was she proud to share with you aspects of what she accomplished in music?
No. Just be honest, she wasn't like, you know, but that's just like, she's not a braggadocious kind of person.
Right.
She is a person who will defend herself now. Like, you know, you're not going to take anything away from her, but she's not going to walk into a room and let you know what she's done. But whenever we would bring it up, she just has this very beautiful, you know, crooked little smile she does and kind of shuts her eyes. I think we all kind of inherited that, kind of like what you see her do on the video, where she's performing Bad Case of the Blues. When she's like, you know, nodding. That's just her. And, you know, she'll smile very gracefully and just, you know, but in order to get information out of her, you got to pry for information. And that's kind of what the documentary was. And, you know, again, she's extremely professional. She's been a professional singer since before Nashville. So she carries herself with a level of professionalism that's just kind of like ingrained in her. So for me doing the documentary with her, she didn't have to talk to, some journalist. She got to talk to her granddaughter, someone who knows her.
Right.
You know, our birthdays are a week apart, so we're very similar, you know. So it was a lot more personal than she ever got, you know. And I apologize. I meant to let you know when I really started to go after securing her legacy. I don't know. It had to be as early as like 2007. I want to say like 2013 maybe was when I got her Twitter account that I can't even get in anymore. So, but yeah, like it was then that I knew, like, you know, her IP was very, very important at this point, and you know, I just whatever I could do to find out how to, you know, secure her legacy, that's what I wanted to do with the very little knowledge I had, you know.
Yeah. Well, I feel like talking about her, we need to hear her. I'd love to hear the single that went to 22 on the country chart, Color Him Father.
There's a man at my house, he's so big and strong. Goes to work each day and he stays all day long. Comes home each night looking tired and beat. He sits down at the dinner table and has a bite to eat. Never frown, always a smile. When he says to me, how's my child? Say that I've been studying hard all day in school, trying very hard to understand.
Yeah, I'm so curious. I mean, making a film about your grandmother is a whole other level of, I mean, you're not making just, you know, videos for the family. This is a highly involved project. It's a huge undertaking. So how did you settle on the idea of making a documentary to tell your grandmother's story?
You know, it's funny because my great grandmother, my grandmother's mother, she passed away last year in January. My mother, like, documented just her life. Like, she would just video her talking about growing up and stuff like that. And I just thought that was so, so freaking cool. And my grandmother and I, like, we've always been close. Like, my mom says, since, you know, I was a baby, I was always like her baby. I was always up under her. So it just, I had already been kind of doing that. You know what I mean? Like, recording our conversations and, you know, just like asking her about her childhood and stuff like that. And, you know, my grandmother's, she's older, and I'm not going to go into any detail, but she's had some health issues that made me very protective of who she's exposed to, how her, you know, wanting to maintain her IP so that her story, so that it's, you know, it's dealt with carefully and not just looked at to, you know, to be something to profit off of. And I just, I don't know. I just wanted to give her a comfortable place to finally get it all out, you know? So, I mean, yeah, that's kind of how, you know, it began with just, you know, me wanting to do what my mom did with her grandmother. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then, like, with the film, realizing, you know, I met with a, you know, someone I met that was kind of helping me through the early stages of getting this, and they were like, you know, Kia, this has the potential to reach like national attention. Like, you really want to invest heavily in the production of this. And so it went from, like, you know, kind of a run and gun situation to, all right, let's make sure this lighting is as good as we can get it. You know what I mean? Let's make sure this audio is as great as we can get it, you know? And we've tried to handle things as professionally as possible. So,
yeah, because you are, you will be sharing it with the world. And yes. I mean, when you do put it out there, what do you want people to learn about your grandmother, her music, her ambitions, and her experiences from the film?
There are real people, you know, with real dreams, real hopes, that are pursuing country music with, you know, genuine love and interest, and they often get looked over because of their skin color. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I really want people to see what that looks like for a woman who accomplished what my grandmother accomplished, you know, like now at 82. You know what I'm saying? I think her experience is a good way of, you know, kind of depicting that, you know, like, and also, I mean, just the pursuit of one's dreams, like, no matter what, like, go after it, you know, because who knows?
Yeah.
You might wind up on a Beyonce, you know what I mean?
I mean, that does make, that does change what seems possible. That's true. Yeah. In this moment.
Yeah. And I mean, whoever knew this would happen. So, I mean, you know, there are no guarantees, but yeah, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's just doing what I can, like I said, to try and secure her legacy.
Yeah.
Tell her story, her perspective.
And Alice, you were talking about when you wrote that piece about Linda Martell. I mean, celebrating her in your writing. You went far beyond simply saying her name, that she existed. You did not treat her as a statistic. You went deep into consideration of her song selection, her vocal style, all of these things.
I think I actually wrote about almost, in the original draft, I wrote about every single cut on the album. But I really want to shout up Marquia's name, Kia, one more time, because I am so thrilled. One of my favorite things about Cowboy Carter is the spotlight is put on Linda Martell. Mm-hmm. But Kia, I want you to know that you're in the last pages of my book. I just opened this up. I want to read this. We will remember to invite Linda Martell and her granddaughter, Marquia Thompson, mm-hmm. who has directed and filmed a documentary telling of the living woman who did the most to pave the way for those who will take the stage. They will be seated in the front row, and I take my seat between Linda and Ebony and lean towards Martell and whisper that I'm as proud to be in her documentary as I was to be in Pride's. Hmm. My point is, Marquia, you were doing this work mm-hmm. when you had to do it with crowdfunding, when you had to do it at this tiny budget. Mm-hmm. You had committed to and have almost fully executed a whole telling of your grandmother's story. And this... Now, Beyoncé has come in to be the most extraordinary ambassador for that story. But I just want to speak of you doing this work for the ancestors and it call in all Black young people around this country to do what Kia is doing for her grandmother.
Yeah.
In your own families. I love that you contextualize it about what your mother did for her grandmother. Mm-hmm. Now, Linda Martell's achievement is extraordinary. That album is a jewel. Mm-hmm. She is so, the voice is beautiful, and her dramatic embodiment of the stories is the highest level of country storytelling singing.
It is.
And your documentary yeah. is such an important part of film storytelling and centering a Black and femme aesthetic in that. And so I just want to, I am thrilled that another layer is
yes.
going to catalyze,
yes.
gives you a catalyst, but I want you to acknowledge you almost had it done before this came out. You had it so far done. I wrote this book and this part before this, I knew about this album.
Yes, layer upon layer, we are celebrating the work. We have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with our guests about how new generations of Black country artists are building coalitions and paying respect to their predecessors like Alice Randall. Join the conversation by tweeting us at This Is Nashville. We will be right back.
On a Greyhound bus, we came here looking for life.
I'm Julie Height, and this is Nashville. If you are just tuning in, I'm your host, Julie Height. We are talking this hour about Cowboy Carter and the Black country lineage it's part of, and the work that Black women, very much including those who are on the show today, have done to reclaim those legacies. My guests are Black Opry founder Holly G, Marquia Thompson, granddaughter of the artist Linda Martell, who's making a documentary about her grandmother, and author, songwriter, educator, and country expert Alice Randall. Alice has a book and an album, both titled My Black Country, coming out next week. And a little later on in April, the Black Opry will devote its third anniversary show to paying tribute to Alice's songs. Now, Holly, I know that you put a lot of thought into how you use the Black Opry stage, that space. So what made you want to devote this anniversary show to the songs of Alice Randall?
I think you talked earlier about like how and if the industry acknowledges the Black people that have made history within it. And the major institutions generally don't. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have spaces where we get to come together and celebrate our history. And so since we had this space where we were coming together already to celebrate, we wanted to add that element to it so that we could, use that celebration for something impactful and just give Alice her flowers because she deserves them.
Yeah. that is something that's very exciting about this moment and this month that the album and the book are coming out. Alice, I love your book, My Black Country. I've read it, I've savored it, I will reread it. And you write of coming to Nashville 4 decades ago, not only to work in music row songwriting and publishing and make strides there, but also to push for Black Country pioneers to get their due and new Black talent to get a chance. Can you tell us about coming to the realization that there were people in the country music industry who knew that they were indebted to the influence of Black musicians, but were not willing to acknowledge it?
You know, Julie, it's almost hard to talk about. It's almost hard to talk about. It was an ongoing. Some of it was actually the lying about some of the history. When I first arrived here, one of the most traumatic things I would experience is that people would tell me the worst things about D4 Bailey. Just because I walk in the room, I'm a Black woman, they can see I'm Black, and they would tell me the story about D4 Bailey. And one of the ways they tell it, I talk about this in the book, was they would say, the people who were trying to encourage me would say, he died shining shoes and living in poverty because he was too lazy to write more songs. And that was almost the people who were trying to encourage me.
That's the way they were trying to discourage me.
They all ended, he died in poverty, shining shoes, and that he never did any more songs. Well, that actually is literally untrue.
Mm-hmm.
D4 Bailey made music until the week he died. He had a son and a grandson that he actually inspired into a musical life.
Mm-hmm.
But more significantly, and I spend a lot of time talking about this in the book, and I discovered this when I was a couple years into my life in Nashville. So I discovered this in the 80s when it was possible for anyone I was encountering to know this as well. And I think many of them did know it. They just didn't share it with me. D4 Bailey wrote and performed a jingle for Senator Avon N. Williams that helped him get elected and become Senator Avon Williams,
right,
the first Black state senator in the history of Tennessee. This is something he does in the 70s.
Yeah.
He actually was not only making music, he was making political music. He was an ally of Avon Williams and helped raise Avon Williams to the state Senate and into a position where he was able to help desegregate, he claimed, every school system in Tennessee except for Shelby County, Memphis. And he was so proud of what D. Ford, that when he had ALS and was very ill at the end of his career in his last campaign, when it was very hard for him to speak, when I said, after writing him a jingle, how does it feel to have your first political jingle? He banged on the table when he could hardly lift his fingers. And he told me, struggling for every breath, D4 Bailey wrote my first jingle. That was on the radio. Those people were, so they were distorting D4's legacy to protect their own image. So I think that, I just want to fast forward to the present because I am all about Black joy is radical. Joy is radical. And what I love about this Oh Happy Day moment for me is when Holly G came to me, the first time we ever had a long lunch together, we've been a couple of panels, and I was completely shocked. I think I teared up. I've been doing a lot of crying this year, and that's not typical for me. And she told me that the Black Opry wanted to honor my legacy, my songwriting legacy, and devote their third anniversary to celebrating some of my songs and new people in the Opry. I was so thrilled because I had lived long enough that there was a Black institution within country music.
Right.
And I was born in Detroit City and the part of it that came straight from Black Bottom, a Black community, an empowered Black community. And it was so thrilling. I may get some more honors in country. I have no idea. But no honor in country will ever mean as much to me as being honored by the Black Opry. Live long enough to see the institution founded that has never degraded D4 Bailey, has never degraded Lil Hardin Armstrong, has never ignored Linda Martell.
Yes, yes.
So that's the institution. I am utterly thrilled. I am happy, and Holly G and Julie, for us to work to bring all these other institutions in the places they need to be to reflect the genius of country, because Black, white, Indigenous, and Asian people have contributed to country.
Yes.
And I'm ready for everybody to realize that. But I am thrilled in this moment to be honored by a Black country institution. And I'm so excited about the Black Opry members, because it has to be about the future as well as the past. And that's what I love about what Holly is doing. And for me, no one's asked me, one of my favorite moments on Cowboy Carter is Protector. I'm a mama, so that's important to me. But it's Rumi's voice at the very beginning. To me, the album looks backward in a very important place to Linda Martell and others.
Right.
And it looks forward with Rumi. And that is that Black Sankofa, looking back to move forward. But Holly G is all about moving us forward. It's a present and the future that is so important. And this cultural redlining, you know, that how do we get the investment in these young artists? Because how do you keep people out of a territory of art the same way you keep them out of a territory of geography? By refusing to finance the thing they're wishing to do. Be it buy a house or make a record.
That's why I'm always harping on the money thing. And I know it sounds probably annoying and entitled, but the truth is that the new artists cannot compete with the mainstream artists without the financial resources. That's
right.
What it all boils down
resources to. Resources and access are huge.
Even if you look at like what's happening in this moment with people that are getting more exposure, like we've suffered from it too. It's like, it's really hard to navigate all of this without a publicist.
Right.
Something that
simple. And you're saying you don't presently have a publicist?
We need one on retainer at this point, but we just don't have the resources for that.
Yeah.
And so if you look at like these newer artists that are now getting all of these streams and these press requests and things like that, in this moment,
a million streams overnight.
How are they able to how do they navigate that? How do they leverage this for the best opportunities? How do they turn it into financial opportunities if they can't afford the help to show them how to navigate that?
Right. Well, you mentioned your songwriting legacy, Alice, and we must explore it. You are here. This is the moment. I mean, since Beyoncé scored a major first in terms of country chart achievement, we cannot skip the one that you achieved with your songwriting 30 years ago. I mean, you were talking about that the Black Opry anniversary show is a special kind of proud moment, but I mean, that was also a monumental achievement. What makes you proudest about your country number one?
One, I'm proud this summer that song will be 30 years old.
Yes.
And it is
30th anniversary in June, right?
June or July. I think it's this summer.
I didn't even realize that. It really was like perfect timing.
It is 30 years old. So I am the only Black woman to write or co-write a certified country classic. This song has been alive in the world and been a country recurrent song for 30 years.
Yes. Yes.
I get interviewed all the time by reporters, and particularly this last 3 weeks, who said they've heard X's and O's their whole life. Like one reporter, she's 30 years old, and she said she doesn't remember not hearing and knowing this song. So I am thrilled, but 2 weeks at number one was big. But you know, it's funny, I just was thinking in an interview, because some of the stuff you just put aside because it's painful, that I was thrilled to have a number one. There's no question. I was thrilled to hear it places. I was thrilled to be in Opryland Park with my daughter and have a Trisha Yearwood sound-alike sing it. But I remember one of the small things I didn't put in my book, because it still stung, was that when my banner was, they put banners on the building when you get a number one with the title, there was a side of the building they usually put it on. As far as I knew, almost always put it on at the time, because it was a side on the street. They put mine on the front so it was perpendicular to the street. You couldn't see it. They did not put my banner, my number one banner. But that didn't stop. Aretha Franklin heard my song and told me she liked it. So that's better than any banner plan. That was the beginning of healing over that one. But the point is, you played a little bit of Sister Strings going into this last break, I think. That was Girls Ride Horses, too.
Yes.
And that was my first top 10. It wasn't my first recorded song. My first recorded song came 2 years after I moved to Nashville. And that was the Forrester Sisters, who were one of the most largest girl groups in 80s country.
Right, right.
And that was an interesting song about religious hypocrisy and slut shaming before we had that phrase. But Girls Ride Horses, too, came in the 80s in the era of Miami Vice. And it was shouting out to the reality that women were getting caught up in the drug trade, and there was differential prosecution and harassment of women by domestic partners sometimes within the trade. And it was trying to inspire women to stand up to this and to find their power to exit it and not be intimidated.
Well, I wonder, I mean, Alice, you eventually got connected with this whole new generation of Black women artists who play banjo and write songs and have been carving out space for themselves and each other within country and roots music circles. And now a dozen of them, including Sister Strings, are reinterpreting your songs on the album that's coming out next week. What is it like? How has it changed the meaning of the intention, the protagonist, the imagination you wrote into your songs, hearing them the way they're reimagined by these women?
One, it's an extraordinary gift. That this posse of brilliant Black women rode to the rescue of my legacy. And I really want to call all of their names. There's Rhiannon Giddens, Allison Russell, Reese Palmer, Miko Marks, Sunny War, who I think is going to be on that wonderful Black Opry show, Adia Victoria, Sister Strings, as you said, Sania, Layla Michaela, and my own Caroline Randall Williams. I love it because it puts, when Rhiannon sings the ballad of Sally Ann about a man who gets lynched between his wedding and reception, it's embodied resistance. People hear it, that she is Sally Ann, and she is loving the man that is killed across death. And she is demanding reckoning throughout her life and in her death. I love that because people are seeing that these characters that I wrote were Black. When Mo Bandy sang Many Mansions, and there's that line, I've seen life stilled by winter's bitter chill. People are imagining a white man dying on the streets, maybe up from the South in New York. When Allison Russell sings it, they are imagining what I saw when I wrote that song, was inspired to write it, a Black woman up from the South dying on the streets of New York in the cold. And she rewrote us and she changed that lyric to, in my mother's house are many mansions. And I love that. And it put that song in conversation with another of my songs, Big Dream, that Valerie June does, which has the line, makes me think maybe God's a woman too. Makes me think maybe God's a woman too. And so we were talking about that in the 20th century, and it wasn't noticed. Reese sings Who's Minding the Garden. That's a song about echo grief, a big topic now.
Right.
But we were writing about echo grief then. Glen Campbell got it. That was a wonderful day in the studio. Glen Campbell looked at me and told me, this song is as important as Galveston. He said that Galveston was an anti-war song and that this environmental justice focus in that song, he said it will be as important as Galveston. With Reese, maybe it will be now.
Well, I encourage everyone listening to seek out not just Cowboy Carter, but Alice Randall's forthcoming album, My Black Country, and her book. And if you are in Nashville when that show happens, the Black Opry's third anniversary show, doing the songs of Alice Randall, to be there, to show up, and to celebrate all of these ways that Black women who are creatives, who are business people, who are writers, are celebrating the legacies of Black voices in country music. Thank you so much, Holly G, Markia Thompson, Alice Randall, for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Julie.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Kia.
Thank you, Alice. Thank you, Holly.
Great art Looking needs great you. Critics, and Julie is a great critic and a great ally.
She's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
And Holly Definitely. Is our new institution.
Yes. The best kind of institution.
Yes.
Thank you for tuning in this hour. This is Nashville is a production of Nashville Public Radio. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Burton and me. It was directed by Tasha A.F. Limley. Our board operator is Liv Lombardi. Live tweeting was handled by Elizabeth Burton. The music we played during this episode is by Beyonce, Linda Martell, Alice Randall, and Sister Strings. Listen back at thisisnashville.org or wherever you get good podcasts. And the conversation does not end here. You can tweet us at thisisnashville. Find us on Instagram. Tell us what you want from our show by filling out our quick survey online. This is Nashville. I'm Julie Height. Show up for each other. Use your brain, y'all.